Start with the 9 purification breaths. We'll add on to it. So, the first of the 3 breaths, whether it's right for you or red for you or white for you, I'll just use the example of red. It's a dark, muddy red light. The second one, it's slightly clearer because you're starting to purify it. And the last one is a crystal clear red light, like a light shining through a ruby. And so for the white, it's an opaque, dense white light, then slightly more luminous, and then a really bright, clear white light, like the sun on snow. And then same for the blue. Opaque, less opaque, and then a very clear blue. And the blue is the color of, it's not now, the color of the sky at autumn, like around this time. It has the blueness of an autumn sky, has this richness to it. Okay, so inhaling up. Breath should be quiet, by the way. And then raising bodhicitta. And so tonight, as we touch in with the desire to be of benefit to all beings, ourselves included, connect it to wanting to show people that they're the flowers already in full bloom. Everyone's suffering because we think we don't even see the seed, but at best we think we're the seed. Our single-pointed intention is to bring benefit and happiness. Good.
Thank you. So let's just sit for a few moments. You can work with your breath through the mantra. You can also work with the meditation we did at the end of the last session. Good. Very nice. Can you all feel the difference in the room tonight? At dinner, Neil and I were saying slash trying to like wrap our head around it. We were like, last night at dinner, we hadn't even had a session yet. Mm-hmm. Like, how is that possible? Does it feel like we've been here longer than 24 hours to you? Regardless of what was happening in your individual mind in the meditation, could you feel the difference in the room from tonight and the other sessions today? It's okay if you can't, but it's good to look because it's by opening and looking that you start to develop a capacity to feel these things. And some of it you don't even be able to, you don't need to be very sensitive or feel deeply. You can just use regular stuff like, oh, there wasn't much fidgeting. People could physically sit still. That's not necessarily an indicator that the mind is still, but something settled, right? There's so many methods and ways to work with the mind and body. Buddhism has almost like a ridiculous array of methods. It's very beautiful. But actually, one way to go deep is to make things very short. Because the psyche knows, oh, it won't be very long, it's safe to go in. You don't think it subconsciously, but it knows it. It's also partly why, at least in this retreat, because we, you know, who knows? We do things differently all the time. But also having moments where there's talking, and also is a little bit of a trick. It's a skillful means to bring you deeper because you release some of the pressure. And also the psyche knows, like, it's okay to go in because I'm gonna come out, you know? And when you do retreat, especially by yourself, like I said, mostly I'm retreating by myself, it's, you're in and out. You can't do a super deep retreat all the time. You can go deep for a few days or a few weeks or something, but then you have to come out because that's just the normal ebb and flow of a mind. So when you hear of people doing long-term retreat, which I haven't done, but what I've been told is that it's also the same. It's not like people are in the depths for 3 years. No, you're coming in and out, you know, like the cycles of the moon or something. Were you raising your hand? How was that last meditation we did at the end of the last session? You got a little taste of how radical Tantra is, what we're doing, and how very personal it is, how extremely expansive it is. So you had that taste. And then you have the taste of the energy that can get activated by chanting, singing together with music.
And how there's both that expansiveness and that craving that can kick in of wanting it to go more. And then, as I said later on, there's, we didn't get there. But when the energy starts to get higher, really high, there's this sense of, oh, I use the example of like you're driving too quickly, or you're on a bike down a hill, and you're like, am I going to lose control of this? And you have to learn how to work with it. And we have experience with that with our emotions. We're good, mindful practitioners. You're trying to hold an emotion. You're trying to hold it in a conversation with a loved one or something, and it's getting higher and higher. And you have to learn, do I have to back off? Can I stay here? Like what, you know? This is all part of it. And Tantra really, so in Tantra, emotions and energy, I mean, not only in Tantra, but we're working with the energies via the emotions. And we're working with the emotions via the energies. The energies are a more subtle aspect of the emotions. But we're not turning away from that. We're moving towards the fullness of experience. And in the same way that the seed has the flower in it, and the flower is the seed, what we think of as the destructive emotions, they have a flower in them of an enlightened quality, an enlightened aspect. So we don't throw, in Tantra, we don't throw the destructive, difficult emotions away. We're actually trying to open into them in such a way that the flower that's a part of them is revealed. Does that make sense? We also talked about some SOS practices, and they can be, you don't need to limit them to like Buddhist practices. A lot of SOS stuff can be just basic self-care. I think some of the most effective things are also other avenues to work with the energetic body, such as acupuncture, herbs, or yoga, and things like this. If you've ever heard me talk, you know I love massage, because I can just lay there. But in terms of practices, there's some classic SOS ones, and one of them is the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. Because you can be pretty off kilter and still manage to say Om Mani Padme Hum. It doesn't take much, you know. And the deeper the relationship you have with it when you're not off kilter, the more it can come to your aid when you are off kilter. And when you feel off kilter, crazy, like, what's the thing you want? I mean, okay, the ego wants it to just go away, right? All right, but we're practitioners. We know that's not, we're like, it just doesn't work, right? If you could make it go away, you would have made it go away. So you're like, fine. Like, what's next? But what next, you just want love. You want compassion. You want someone to be there with you, to care that you're hurting. And ideally to help you, but at the very least, just be there with you, with warmth and tenderness. And that's what compassion is. It's showing up, it's being there. It's initially the desire to help, and ultimately the ability to help, to really help. And so it makes sense that a compassion mantra helps when you feel really off kilter. And especially as practitioners, there can be a sense of like, well, I shouldn't be feeling this way, or this shouldn't still be happening. And again, it compounded existence is unstable. And so you're gonna have those moments. It is part of the process. And it's gonna keep coming even as you advance on your path. So I think the more you can normalize it, nothing's gone wrong, it doesn't mean you're not a good practitioner yet. This is just how it is. And all the lamas and all the meditators, we all have these moments and we all have these practices we turn to in those moments. And the practices can and do shift as you move along your path. But certainly Om Mani Padme Hum and Tara, which we're going to talk about tonight, are really foundational, accessible, pivotal ones that you can use without an initiation. They're right there for you. They're very open, very openly taught. And they're very much like alive and kind of like in the ether, you know, which is a blessing because one day it won't be. But now they are, so we can use it. How lovely. So also this afternoon, we talked a little bit about purification and collecting merit as not only in preparation for the tantric path, but also just part and parcel of the tantric experience. And the text, the tantras, the sadhanas, built into them are all these like moments and rituals around purifying and collecting merit. So much of the liturgies, right? Practice text, sadhanas, is that. And you're taking refuge, and you're spending a lot of time thinking, or like it, they call it raising, you know, raising bodhicitta, thinking of the four immeasurables, cultivating what we started to touch on today, this, it's called divine pride, this like, me? I could be a Buddha? And trying it on, what is that? What does that feel like? In many of the texts, there's aspects where you confess, but it's not in a sense of like, I'm so bad. It's in a sense of laying yourself bare, like being naked, not literally, but in the metaphorical sense of like, okay, here I am. Like I'm gonna stop posturing for a few minutes and just be like, yeah, I'm the whole mixed bag. I'm doing beautiful things, I'm confused, I'm doing hurtful things, I don't mean to. Like, here's my guilt, here's my everything. You're just sort of like, it's this practice of stop hiding. And you stop hiding in front of a Buddha, a visualized Buddha, because they're a very safe thing to stop hiding in front of. Their only thing they ever think about is helping you. That's it. They're just love. So it's a good one to practice in front of, right? But even that, it's hard. And I don't know, because I don't know inside people's minds, but I have the impression that there are a lot of tantric practitioners who are doing the reading the text and doing all these mudras and things with bells and vajras with their hands, but they're not naked in that sense of just like being open. And why do we practice being open in front of a Buddha? Because that's how we learn to be open to ourselves. We can't do it with ourselves. We can't even conceptualize it. It's so much easier to do it in front of a Buddha than with yourself. And this is an imagined Buddha, right? This is where we are. And it's through that that you start to learn to open actually to your own self. So also in these texts, and they're all different, and they're all of varying lengths, and the systems of the energy channels and the colors and the chakras, they change from different tantric systems. This is a vast canon of systems. And some are compatible, some overlap, and some are wildly different. Big deal. They all work. And you don't need to get caught up into like, well, this one says this, and this one says this. And by the way, they almost all say, whichever one you're reading, they're like, this is the best one. It's true. And then you open the next one, and it's like, you've got the best one. You're so fortunate. You're so lucky. Because the techniques combined with bodhicitta, combined with these elevated views of emptiness and openness and possibility and interdependence, and luminosity, they all work. And different ones have worked for different bodies. Because we're bodies, right? And we have like subtle energies, but it's almost like electrical currents. And people are wired a little differently. And we all have different life experiences and different things that we're attracted to or repulsed by. And so the tantras fit different bodies and experiences and personalities and proclivities. Some people do really well with really, really, really complex visualization because it gets so complex that they for once can't think in a good way, right? And for some people that's just overwhelming and super complicated, and really simple direct things work. Your teacher will help you find the right ones for you. But I do want you to know that they're all different, and they're like standalone. But one common feature of the longer ones, they're now becoming, teachers are making them shorter to fit our lifestyle and our kind of like our minds and our capacities. But especially the longer ones, there's just multiple times where you're making offerings to the Buddhas within them as a means of honoring the qualities of enlightenment. And it's like our training wheels, we're honoring the qualities of enlightenment that we're visualizing in terms of a visualized Buddha. But they're also our own qualities. They're just, we just perceive them in seed form in ourselves. So when you honor a Buddha, you know, in the visualization you offer some flowers, some incense, some oil, things like this. Because everything's interconnected, you're also honoring that those your own enlightened qualities, right? So you pay homage on the outside, but it's helping you get in touch with your inner qualities as well. Same with like as you cultivate what's called divine pride, Vajra pride, as you start to sense and feel, explore, try on, get used to the fact that you don't exist the way you think you do. The world's not flat, even though you experience it that way. By getting in touch with your own awakened potential, you get closer to the actual Buddhas. In the same way that real self-compassion helps you extend compassion to others. And real compassion outward builds it to yourself, because the idea of self and others, it doesn't actually hold water. So of course it's interconnected. Does that make sense? Okay. So we read, we read that first chapter from Shantideva, The Excellence of Bodhicitta. And the second chapter it's actually about confession. But the first part of the confession chapter, chapter two, is making offerings to the Buddhas. And I think it's so, so beautiful and very uplifting. So I wanted to read that to you, because as I said, offerings are such a part of a tantric liturgy. And part of the reason that the offering and the homage is a part of it is because one offers and expresses admiration or devotion to admirable qualities based on openness, based on your own dignity, is what enables you to give and to rejoice in others. Does that make sense? Oh, I love this. Okay. To the Buddhas, those thus gone, and to the sacred Dharma, spotless and supremely rare, and to the and to the Buddha's offspring. Bodhisattvas are called Buddha's offspring. Sometimes they're called children of the Buddhas. Annoyingly, they're often called sons of the Buddhas. We don't need to say that anymore. Sons and daughters. Daughters, but that's what it means, Buddha's offspring. To the Buddhas, those thus gone, and to the sacred Dharma, spotless and supremely rare, and to the Buddha's offspring, oceans of good qualities, that I might gain this precious attitude, I make a perfect offering. I offer every fruit and flower, every kind of healing draft, and all the precious gems the world contains, with all pure waters of refreshment. Every mountain wrought of precious jewels, all sweet and lonely forest groves, the trees of paradise adorned with blossoms, trees with branches bowed with perfect fruit, the perfumed fragrance of divine and other realms, all incense, wishing trees, and trees of gems, all crops that grow without the tiller's care, and every sumptuous object worthy to be offered. Lakes and mirrors adorned with lotuses, delightful with the sweet-voiced cries of water birds, and everything unclaimed and free extending to the margins of the boundless sky. I hold them all before my mind, and to the mighty sage, the greatest of our kind, and to his heirs, I make a perfect offering. Sublime recipients, compassionate lords, think of me with love. Accept these gifts of mine. For, destitute of merit, I am very poor. I have no other wealth. And so, protectors, you whose wise intentions are for others' good, and your great power, receive them for my sake. Enlightened ones and all your bodhisattva heirs, I offer you my body throughout all my lives. Supreme courageous ones, accept me totally. For with devotion, I will be your servant. For if you will accept me, I will be undaunted by samsara and will act for being's sake. I'll leave behind the evils of my past and ever after turn my face from them. A bathing chamber, excellently fragrant, with even floors of crystal, radiant and clear, and graceful pillars shimmering with gems, all hung about with gleaming canopies of pearls. There the blissful Buddhas and their heirs all bathe with many a precious vase, abrim with water fragrant and delightful, all the frequent strains of melody and song, with cloths of unexamined quality, spotless perfumed towels, I will dry them and offer splendid scented clothes, well dyed and of surpassing excellence, with different garments, light and supple, and 100 beautiful adornments. I will grace sublime Samantabhadra, Manjugosha, Lokeshvara, and their kin. And with a sumptuous fragrance which pervades 1,000,000,000 worlds, I will anoint the bodies of the mighty sages, gleaming bright like burnished gold, refined and cleansed. I place before the mighty sages, perfect objects of my worship, glorious flowers like lotus and mandarva, the utapala, and other fragrant blossoms worked and twined in lovely scented garlands. I will offer swelling clouds of frankincense, whose ambient perfume ravishes the mind, and various foods and every kind of drink, all delicacies worthy of the gods. I will offer precious lamps arranged in rows on lotuses of gold, a carpet of sweet flowers scattering upon the level, incense-sprinkled ground. To those whose very nature is compassion, I will give vast palaces resounding with fair praise, all decked with precious pearls and beauteous pendant gems, gleaming jewels that deck the amplitude of space. Fair and precious parasols adorned with golden shafts, all bordered round with hems of precious jewels, upright, well-proportioned, pleasing to the eye. Again, all this I give to all the Buddhas. May a host of other offerings and clouds of ravishing sweet melody that solaces the pain of living beings arise and constantly abide. May rains of flowers and every precious gem fall down in an unceasing stream upon the jewels of sacred Dharma, images, and all supports for offering. Just as Manjugosha and the like made offering to all the conquerors, I do likewise to all the Buddhas, our protectors, and to all their Bodhisattva children. To these vast oceans of good qualities, I offer praise, a sea of airs and harmonies. May clouds of tuneful eulogy ascend unceasingly before them. To the Buddhas of the past, the present, and all future time, and to the Dharma and sublime assembly, with bodies many as the grains of dust upon the earth, I will prostrate and bow. To shrines and all supports of bodhicitta, I bow down. To abbots who transmit the vows, to every learned master, to all sublime practitioners of Dharma. Until the essence of enlightenment is reached, I go for refuge to the Buddhas. I also take refuge in the Dharma and in the hosts of Bodhisattvas. So go ahead and close your eyes. And here, this is a moment of expansion and creativity. So when we think about the Buddhas, because we have the seed of enlightenment ourselves, we're making offerings to our own future enlightened qualities. It's not separate from us. Now let your mind dance and play. What delightful things would you like to offer? And in the same way that the verse said, with bodies as many as particles of dust on the earth, I prostrate. You can make your offerings vast. If you want to offer an orchid, why not the sky filled with orchids? Okay, I would like to know what came to mind. I already gave you one. I shared one of mine, right? The sky filled with orchids. Oh, oh.
I was like, what do I like?
This is getting very tantric. Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's cool for many reasons. One is because, well, starting at the base, you know, we've been socialized to think that sex is bad. And we already talked about how within just so-called destructive emotions, such as anger, there's the potential for enlightened qualities. So within anger, there's the potential for what's called mirror-like wisdom, which is a clarity that perfectly reflects back without adding anything else. Very, very precise, crisp, clear. So even if you thought sex and orgasms were bad, it's still within bounds because we can say, oh, there's an enlightened quality, some enlightened aspect to it. But sex and orgasms aren't bad. I was raised Catholic, by the way, and I went to Catholic school from pre-K to 12. So as I'm saying this out loud, I'm saying it to myself, you know? You guys are like, yeah, I know. I'm like, well, I don't totally know yet. But the tantric expression of compassion is bliss, which, as I said earlier, has the, in your body, it feels like orgasming. It's an energy that feels just like that, which is why sex has been part of some tantra, not all. Sometimes it's visualized, sometimes it's symbolic, sometimes it's acted out. And because, so there, that's already there and cool, right? But what would make it really cool and really powerful is we've been talking about the indivisibility, the union, the inseparability of wisdom and compassion, right? Two wings of the bird. This is very classic Dharma. And then as the wisdom and expressions of wisdom and compassion become more refined in the tantric systems, we have the wisdom of emptiness, which gets expressed and experienced as clear light, and the expression of compassion, which gets expressed and experienced as bliss, become non-dual. They become in union, which is why you see those Buddhas in union, right? And so the experience of bliss can trigger the direct perception of emptiness or clear light. So that seems like a very nice thing to offer someone. the direct experience of the highest form of reality, which feels like orgasming. So yeah, seems pretty good. What else?
I had a platter full of perfectly ripe mangoes.
Oh man, that's a good one.
You said make it bigger, so cool.
I love it.
It's the second highest form.
Very nice, very nice. What else? That's awesome. Beautiful, beautiful. I'm going to use that one.
First, I was offering flowers and really expansive, you know, bouquets filling, you know, as much space as I could imagine. And then I was imagining a procession of humans, like beautiful, luminous figures, and like really, really, you know, obese, overflowing, just enormous, I don't know, joyous people. And then finally I was imagining it was like a catwalk of a fashion show, just like beautiful beings in really, you know, outlandish fashion.
You guys are like, every question I'm just like, are you guys in my head? You know what I'm supposed, what I was going to talk about next? It's like so cool. Okay, so. Generosity in the tantric system is associated, it's got a direction, it's got a color, it's got a body type. Its direction is the south. Its color is a golden saffron yellow because it's really rich. And it's depicted as these big, beautiful, voluptuous women that are just like overflowing with qualities and joy and just like, yeah, just that overflowing, this feeling of abundance and this feeling of, you don't, you know those, because there's people like that, right? And within their presence, you never know what's going to happen, right? There's this sense of like, you know? But you know it's going to be fun and loud. So that's associated with generosity. And then what's associated with compassion and bliss is like fashion and sexy and sleek. And like, it's like all the, and there's, it's like, I don't want to say like the models, because there's something more kind of like, because our current standards of like models and beauty, they're not totally magnetizing. Like they're kind of angular and a little like thin or something. This is more like there's just something like statuesque and really beautiful and fashionable, like that it's magnetizing, and it's associated with the color red, and the direction is the west, the setting sun, things, you know. Oh, it's time for a glass of wine and we light a candle. It's like that. So that's very beautiful. You're tapping into some mandala energy there. Good, what else? Yeah.
All of the people on Earth simultaneously saying, thank you.
That's beautiful. Do you all know the refuge visualization? Classic refuge visualization. So when you take refuge, you imagine every other being on earth also taking refuge with you. And it's like, it's actually supposed to be a moment, it's like a sutra level of divine pride where they're kind of, you're inspiring them to take refuge. Like you're doing it all together, but you're kind of like the leader. And it's like you've got your arms around them, kind of like, all right, you're safe now. We're taking refuge in reality as it really is. That's very beautiful.
What are the other two directions?
So we have the east, which is associated the color blue. We'll quiz Neil here. Do you remember anything else about the east?
I have my notes
here. No, it's okay. I was just curious. It takes a long, long time. It's no big deal. I'm trying to think how much I said with each of them. It's associated with mirror-like wisdom, that clarity I was talking about. The element is water. I didn't give the other elements for those. And the person is very scientific, very precise, very angular. They have an ability to see clearly, to completely cut through the BS. My partner is like that. It's so annoying. he's just like, and I'm like, oh. It's associated with science. And then the one we're actually going to talk about tonight is the north. And its color is green. And it's associated with activity, getting things done, accomplishing, but not without any sense of drive or competition or like, you know, that thing we all bring into getting stuff done. It's this very open, like, go with the flow, and by being super open, things get done. And the quality is air, and so it's very, very fluid. And these are the people that don't stop moving. They're always working, always getting something done. My best friend is like that. She's just constantly doing something. And I'm just like on the couch like, wow, you know? And then there's a middle one. And the middle one, the color is white, and it's all-encompassing, all-pervading, and it's associated with wisdom, the wisdom of emptiness, the truth of emptiness and interdependence and luminosity and awareness that is all-pervading and inside everything and inseparable from us and everything else. And those people are... they're like softer, rounder, like rounded faces, and there's a soft element to it. And like their home is very like white and spacious and like peaceful. There's this real sense of peace with it. And the only reason it's like depicted in the center is because like how do you depict what's all around, you know? And this is what makes up a mandala, which is a circular representation, three-dimensional representation of a world, the way we experience it. And so part of the tantric practice is visualizing the ordinary world as a Buddha field, as a mandala, where everything's pure, everything is in its flower form, but the seed is still there. So like, even within the mere like precise clarity, the aspect of anger doesn't go away. You can't separate them. You can't separate the anger from the clarity. The generosity, that big overflowing yellow, you never know what's gonna come next and out. The underbelly side of that, the encumbered side of that, is pride or arrogance or its close cousin, insecurity. Because both are reifying the self. I'm so great or I'm so lame. It's still about you and not about this openness, this equality. When it's from this like open equality that the giving arises. And the underbelly of compassion or bliss is this craving, And you can see it in the magnetism, right? The magnetizing is beautiful. But often when we're magnetized by something, we want to own it. Take it, because we feel separate from it. Compassion, there's no owning. There's no separate. It's the breaking down of separation. You're not separate. You're hurting. You're not separate from me, therefore I want to help you. The underbelly of the all-accomplishing, the getting things done, the green in the north, is jealousy or envy. And it's that sense of like, I'm not doing enough, I gotta keep up. Oh my God, they've got that, I don't have that, I haven't done that. That feeling, not being enough, not doing enough. And then the underbelly of the Buddha, it's the Buddha family, which is confusing, but that's the one in the center. The all-pervading is ignorance. And it's either checking out, like, just, it's like a disassociating almost. And it can be just like, you can't go there, but it can also be a willful turning away. And it can be like an unconscious compulsive turning away, too. And some sort of feeling or expression that like we're not all interconnected, therefore I don't have to engage with it. I went through all of them, right? You don't have to remember all this, it's a lot. Did you have a hand up? Do you have a question?
Yeah. I have a question in terms of this metaphor of seeing the flower from the seed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The flower is Buddha, the flower is mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if the direction is opposite how it feels like to see the seed from the flower. How does it feel like?
Yeah. So, well, for a Buddha, it's like the seed is already fully expressed as the flower. But when they see us, they see the seed. We don't even see the seed, right? We're not walking around thinking about the seed of my enlightenment, you know? If we did, we'd have much more, we'd have a little pep to our step, right? But mostly we're like, I'm not even the seed, there's just like, some dirt, and we're like, maybe there's some teacher out there, some text or some religion that'll put the seed in me. And then we're like, and I swear to God, I'm gonna water that seed, I'm gonna do whatever you say, I'm gonna make it grow, but can you give me the seed? We don't even feel like we have it. The Buddha, so we're walking around like, there's no seed, this is terrible, I'm crying, I'm suffering. And the Buddhas see the seed. And by seeing the seed, they also see the full bloom of it at once. So that's one aspect. But I mixed my metaphors at one point. I don't know if you caught it, but I'll call myself out on it. I mixed it by saying also that that the full expression of generosity. No, that's, I don't want to mix it like that. That mirror-like wisdom has the seed, has the aspect of anger in it, has the energy of anger in it. And we think, oh, I have to purify the anger. And then I'll get to the mirror-like wisdom. But the energy of mirror-like wisdom is not separate from the energy of anger. You don't have to get rid of the anger. You transform it, but it never like, it doesn't, it's all one and the same. The seed and the fruit are still there together.
Okay, so let's get back to offerings just for a second. We're going to go back to this other stuff that we're talking about. But so there's many texts, there's many rituals. This is my favorite. I think it's so beautiful. Where you're making offerings and they're kind of a, what's the word I'm looking for? There's like, it's like a script. I offer this, I offer this, I offer this. It's a litany of things. It's really nice to offer from your own mind and your own imagination, because then it's alive and pure. And the beautiful thing about this is, if we say, go out and buy flowers, we're already like, well, how much is that going to cost? And then if we're like, go out and buy a room of flowers or a pool of flowers, then we're like, you know? But it's just in your mind. It's totally free. And the interesting thing is, it's even hard to give free imaginary things in your mind. Right? So there's something about it, you know? And it's just, it's a practice in opening the mind. I mean, who said it? Maybe you said it, of like, as much as I could imagine. It's hard to even imagine big, to think big. So it's an exercise in thinking big. And then giving big. But it's tied to the things that please you, right? It's not some other thing. There's a really nice Tibetan Buddhist practice. Have you all seen on Tibetan Buddhist altars, they have these water bowls? Have you seen these? The idea is, and there's often seven bowls, there's eight offerings. They each represent something, and they symbolize qualities that we need on the path. So it is still nice to make the traditional ones because of the symbolism. But the idea behind offering water is because it's free and relatively easy to get. So you don't run up against your own stinginess, right? So these are like the little tricks that we use to enhance our own generosity. And I run up against water bowl offerings all the time. I'm like, I don't know if I can really walk to the kitchen in my like studio apartment. You know, it's like right there. And I'm like, oh, maybe tomorrow. I'm already sitting down. You know, you run up against your own stuff. So it's very nice, I think, when you sit down this is super traditional, right? You would take refuge, you would take the bodhicitta, and then you'd make offerings in your mind, and you can just do it in your mind, and you can play. It's also an exercise in creativity, which is a big part of Tantra. Guess what? You use your own creativity to become enlightened. Shocker. It doesn't come from someone else's ideas. It comes from yours. And comes from the things that inspire you and light you up. And then on the days where you're too depressed or you don't have the energy to be creative, because creativity takes energy, or you just don't have like inspiration, then you can read one of those texts. You know? He did such a nice job. The lakes and mirrors adorned with lotuses and the sweet-voiced cries of water birds. Like, oh. Thanks. Thanks, Shantideva. And the idea we'll talk about this more tomorrow, but the classic Bodhisattva training path, there's several systems, but the most classic here is elucidated by Shantideva. Is the six perfections, or six paramitas, or six transcendent virtues. Starts with generosity, because as I've been saying, generosity is predicated on openness, which is a direct correlation to how reality exists. It's not fixed, it's open, it's empty, it's spacious, everything is possible. Everything is, and because of that, it's all changing and compounded and coming together and falling apart and all wiggly and shimmery like that, even though we see it as solid and stable.
And when we touch in with generosity, with giving, with openness, it seems like it's something we're doing on the outside, but it's actually what enables us to be. It only works one way. Real openness is like, if you're open on the moving out, it means that there's an opening moving in. So when you give outward in your mind to the Buddhas, you open the channel to receive inspiration, blessing. And it's not like their wisdom is separate from you coming into you. It's a channel where you're like, oh, it was already in you all along. You're just like, oh, that's the seed. And then one day you're like, oh, it's been a flower all along. Like that. So when you give, that's the idea behind it. It's about being able to receive. And we all have experience, obviously, with ourselves, but it's harder to see it with ourselves, with other people who have a difficult time giving, they have a very difficult time receiving as well. You know, there's like a, you can watch, you can see this. There's walls up. And we all have them too. It's just harder often to see in ourselves. Because to take them down is very vulnerable. It's very spacious. But there's no way around it. In the same way that I was saying, that feeling of joy and sadness coming together, you can't get the joy without the sadness. You can't get this big, beautiful space without the vulnerability with it. But the vulnerability transforms into this incredible spaciousness. And the sadness transforms into this beautiful joy. But they're still not separate, you know? Good. Any questions on that? Okay. So I wanted to teach you this other mantra, the Tara mantra. And it was so nice. Barry put this beautiful green Tara statue in my room for me. It just arrived there. And so green Tara is associated with the north. And with this all accomplishing activity, she's associated with the wind, which is our energies, and she helps with anxiety and fear, and that feeling of I'm not enough, or I can't do enough, or you know. And my gosh, was it just this morning we did Om Mani Padme Hum? It feels like 3 weeks ago or something. So Om Mani Padme Hum is the male Buddha of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. And the story, it's a beautiful story. Avalokiteshvara was witnessing the suffering of the world and he cried. And then Tara was born from his tear to help reach out to beings who are suffering. And even though she was born of his tear, she's smiling, she's laughing. So it's a lesson that we can bear witness to the suffering, but we can be joyous. And in fact, the best way we can help is to be joyous, because it's a sense of energy, right? Very hard to help when you're down in the dumps yourself. So there's 22 aspects of Tara, but she's most commonly depicted, her main aspect is this green aspect. And she's depicted, oh, this one doesn't have it. She's depicted usually with her right leg like this, because she's getting up to go help you. She's like in action. Which makes sense, because I said she's associated with this all-accomplishing action, right? She's moving. And her right hand is extended, as this one is. This is the posture of generosity, giving. And her left hand is holding the Utapa flower, which is blue, and it symbolizes compassion, wisdom. And so I'm going to write it down for you. But Om Mani Padme Hum and Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha, these are like the two, not like, these are the two compassion mantras. And they're recited by lay people who have zero education or Buddhist practice or anything, but it's like their heart practice. Just saying the mantra, that's all many Tibetans know, it's just to say the mantra, but there's devotion in their heart. So it like makes the mantra powerful. But it's also recited by very deep, very skilled practitioners. These are major, major practices. And to me, it's very beautiful that it's the most simple, accessible, sort of like mundane practices. And they're the ones that some of the greatest masters have reached realizations with, these same words, these same deities. Something that's unique to Tantra is bringing in the feminine and the depiction of enlightenment within a feminine form and a female body. And it's just so beautiful and so important that we have that. And I think I might have mentioned it on the first night, my Friday, your Monday. That in Buddhism in general, but really strongly in Tantric Buddhism, it's the feminine is associated with wisdom. And male is associated with compassion or skillful means. There's a really lovely teacher I really admire. She's like one of my spiritual heroes. Her name is Jitsuma Tenzin Palmo. She just turned 80. And she did like 14 years. She lived in a cave in the Himalayas for 14 years. There's a nice memoir about her called Cave in the Snow. She's an English woman. Did I say that? She's English. And she's made her life work to train Tibetan nuns who traditionally haven't gotten at all the same training. It's just like been really bad. So she's like training them scholastically to the same level as the highest trained men, as the monks, and training them as real practitioners so that they can go out and teach. Where was I going with this? Enlightened feminine. I don't know, I'll remember in a moment. There's something she said about Tara. Oh, I know what it was. They were always talking about the indivisibility between compassion and wisdom. And the Mahayana, she's Mahayana, she's Tibetan. We're always talking about, like, compassion's the best. We're using compassion as the means to access wisdom. And she was talking about wisdom being associated with the feminine. And she's like, come on, we all know wisdom's higher. Like, wisdom's obviously what it's about. And as a woman, you know, as like the underdog, I'm like, yeah, wisdom is the best one. It's not the right way to think. There is no better or worse, right? But also wisdom's the best. 99% of the time you're going to hear me say compassion's the best. You will, you will, you will. Good. Okay, so I'm just gonna make sure that I'm gonna write the Tara mantra up there. Or maybe Neil's gonna do it. I'm just gonna bring it up to make sure we spell it right. Wanna write this up there for me? You can take that down. Should we have a break? We're going to take a 10-minute break? 5-minute break? Yeah.
What does Buddhism have to say about the ego?
Say it again?
What does Buddhism have to say about the ego?
About the ego?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I don't know. Maybe let's take a 5-minute break. And then I'll do it when we get back. Because I see people are kind of getting up and stuff. To be continued in 5 minutes. You know, there's a really funny story of I'm trying to see if I'm conflating two Dharma stories in my mind. There's a story of someone who goes to a remote island, and there's a practitioner there, and he's saying a mantra, and the guy who's calm is like, "You're saying it wrong. Like that's not the mantra." But as the guy who's saying it wrong on the island is saying it, he starts levitating. And he's like, he's like floating. He's like, "I'm saying it wrong. Will you teach me the right way?" And the other guy's like, "It's fine, it's fine." But they do say it's important to say the mantras correctly. Oh, right. Okay, so one thing I'm going to send out, or Dharma Gates is going to send you, some list of resources, and one of them will be this book. The Sanskrit title is Bodhicharya Avatara, and in English it's been translated many, many times. The translation I've been reading to is called The Way of the Bodhisattva, and it's by a translation group called Padmakara, and that's the one I've been reading. Okay, so you asked, what does Buddhism have to say about ego? Well, there's a... ego in the sense of like psychology, it's important to have a healthy ego. This is where we're not getting enmeshed with other people. This is where we can honor our own needs, and we're not doing sort of like fake compassion. Fake's not quite the right word, but it's more like a codependent compassion where you're overgiving. It's imbalanced, it's not healthy. There's not that sense. When we overgive, we've lost the sense of self, the interdependency of self, right? So it's important to have a strong ego in that sense. And when I was first studying and living at the Zen Center, I remember once we had someone come to like the Sunday service, and you know, they hung out with the community all day, and then afterwards at dinner our teacher was like, their ego is not strong enough, like I can't take them as a student, because what Buddhism does is it breaks down the ego. So you have to have a healthy sense of self first in order to unravel it. Otherwise, there's no stability, right? But from the dharmic sense, ego is the thing that thinks the world is flat. Ego is the thing that thinks there's no seed. It's just this weird, barren dirt, and we've got to look outside to find the seed. And then we have to work really hard to make it grow. Ego is the confused aspect. It's ignorance. Ego is the thing that innately believes that self and others are separate and then constantly reifies it every millisecond of every day. And in that sense, ego is the quote-unquote problem, right? But also, so in that way, ego is associated with ignorance. But all pervasive wisdom, luminous emptiness, the center of the mandala, that's the transformed aspect of ignorance. So I don't want to knock ignorance. I don't want to knock ego, because that's the very thing that's I'm gonna perceive as enlightenment. So we work with ego. We love it. We bring it along with us. It's our buddy. And ego is brilliant. Its brilliance is astonishing. I mean, I can't get over how cool and smart ego is. And I think a really, really good elucidation of ego is Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche's Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. Absolutely classic, iconic book, and talks about the six paramitas, and it also talks some about the mandala I've just been talking about too. I can't recommend it enough. I read it late in life, and then I read it 7 times in a row.
Wait, what's it called?
Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. And it's on an Audible book, and I really like the reader. I feel there's some transmission there.
I guess I'm thinking about the concept of no self,
mm-hmm.
as it comes up, and then knowing that there's an ego. It's like the self is very fractured, like the self that feels emotions, the self that thinks. Is it all like bridging it into a unitary thing that's not even the self?
So the self, what we experience as a self, is fractured. It's a bunch of hodgepodge, constantly changing, interrelated, fairly random things that we have netted together and said, me. And that's ego's brilliance. Ego's the thing that threw the net over it and then was like, me. And then everything we run up against, just ego says, yeah, me. Like in response. I don't know if that.
Yeah.
And so what Buddhism's saying is, yeah, I know, it's a self. You see, you really feel it as a self, and that's valid. You are a you, and I am a me. But the thing that you experience intrinsically as some actual self is just this hodgepodge of changing things that are changing and will fall apart. Yeah. Okay, so here's another thing I was going to say. I forget your name. What's your name?
I'm David.
Oh yeah, obviously. David was saying that he went to a temple where instead of a Buddha, there's a big golden Tara. And my teacher's temple is called Tara Mangala. And in it, there's 21 golden Taras. And the temple is shaped like a mandala, and the inside is circular. And it's got all these images of the divine feminine. And it's very beautiful and very inspiring if you're into like divine babes or whatever. Because we're so used to seeing the masculine depiction of enlightenment. It's very nice to see the feminine and to give rise and embodiment and voice to the feminine qualities. So that it is out there. And my teacher Lama Sultram wrote a really lovely book about the mandala called Wisdom Rising. that goes through these five, they're called Buddha families or mandala directions, and talks about the qualities and gives meditations within the book to help us transform, for example, anger into mirror-like wisdom, or pride into equanimity, or craving into compassion, like that. Okay, so Tara. Her quality is talked about as anyone who evokes her name or her mantra, she comes instantly to your aid. Like that's the quality of Green Tara. And it doesn't matter if you're a good or a bad person, like none of it. She is only seeing the full flower of us, and she's right there. So she's a great SOS mantra, and she really works with fear, and as I said, anxiety. And when we talk, when we've been working with the winds here in the channel, which are the subtle energies of the body, Tara is associated with wind and energy. And often when we feel upset, it's because our inner energies are agitated. And it might not even have very much to do with your mind. Like being on the phone agitates your energies. Running around, just like running errands or like getting stuff done, agitates your energies. The internet agitates your energies, right? So Tara, and when you meditate really nicely, it stirs the energies up. And so Tara helps to soothe that. So it's Om Tare Tutare Ture Soha. Om Tare Tutare Ture Soha. Can I say it with me? Om Tare Tutare Ture Soha. Om Tare Tutare Ture Soha. Okay. So Soha, you know how I said they start with Om and they have these different endings. One is Hum, another popular one is Soha. It's technically Svaha, S-V-A-H-A, but it's kind of hard to say, so it sort of comes out as Soha. So if you see Svaha or Soha, it's the same. There's also something about reaching out, and I think there's something reaching out to Tara, in my experience, carries some extra energy or blessings with it. When we reach out, it's also a way of breaking down ourselves, of saying like, not only do I not have to do it all, but I can't do it all because I don't exist in isolation. And it takes some kind of openness and vulnerability to be like, please help me, you know? And it's on that openness and vulnerability that she can ride in, right? And I think there's something, if you practice mantras or you practice the tantras, you start to get to know, it's like it's almost like the personality of the various Buddhas. They have these, their specific qualities and characteristics. And there's something, you know, Tara is like, she's feminine. She's called Mother Tara. And there's something, I think because she's feminine, because she's a mom, but it's kind of like the energy embedded in her that when we open up to her, she responds so fully. So fully. It's like the fullness of this like perfect, perfect compassion. She's so sweet and kind. So sweet. It's like a overwhelming goodness. It's like it's what she radiates. And when she comes to you, that's what she comes with. And her feeling, her expression of overwhelming goodness shows you that you're the same and that you're worthy. So I thought it might be nice as we learn and practice and kind of integrate the Tara Mantra, we can do it with the recording tonight and kind of close it out like that. You can, maybe cue it up. You can sing it, or you can just listen and kind of open yourself up to it. Or you can also say it very quietly under your breath. People shouldn't hear you when you're saying the mantra, though. It's very, very soft. There's something very personal and private about mantra, right? It's connected to secret. Secret, right? Because it's so private, so intimate, right? Neil, what do you think? I think we should turn off the lights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Question? Yeah. Maybe question. What do the words mean again?
Oh, they don't. It's just her name.
So is it like conjugating Tara?
No, just hold it. It's not going to help you to understand it. We have to get to something underneath the intellect. Wisdom is underneath the intellect.
Do you want this one?
I kind of do.
Yeah.
Let's see. What? I think so. Will you put this up there? Oh, we can dim it. Oh, I forgot. Thank you. Wherever you like. This is Kuan Yin. She's a female Buddha of compassion from the Chinese tradition. Or this will say East Asian. So, we're going to set the stage for Tara. You're anxious. You've been running around, you're destabilized, you don't know what's going on. There's this sense of desperation that we all get sometimes. Sometimes you're just overwhelmed and busy, and sometimes it's like, something deeper, but you just want, like you're at your wit's end, you want help, you need help. And then all you have to do is call on Tara, say her mantra, and it's that reaching out, that openness that she rides in on, right? And she responds, because she's associated with the wind, she responds super swiftly. She's instantly there. And whether or not you can feel her instantaneous presence, I don't know if you'll be able to feel it yet, but she does come instantly. And in time, the more open you are, the more you can feel it, and then you can have a real experience of her. And that overwhelming sense of goodness and warmth and kindness that absolutely nourishes you and lifts you up and makes you know that you are good and the world is good and everything is good and okay. This is what we're opening up to when we either listen to this mantra that we're about to play or you yourself say it or chant along with it.
Thank you.
see if you can be present. See if you can be present with what is. Very bare. Very naked in the sense of nothing between you and what is. Welcoming everything because everything has the seed of enlightenment in it. And if you push it away, you miss that flower. So be open and dance with it. Like singing in the rain. Throw away the umbrella. And if the rain becomes too hard, the thunder and lightning becomes too scary, you just call on Tara. She'll become the umbrella till the storm passes. And if you keep calling on her, she'll teach you how to dance in the rain. And in the end, the rain and the sun will be exactly the same to you, equally beautiful and joyous. Let's dedicate the merit, not only from this session, but from the whole day. So in this session, we read sacred scripture. We made offerings to the Buddhas from our own minds, our own creativity. Touching in with the spark of joy that that brings. We talked about the mandalas, the enlightened aspects of our encumbered patterns, such as anger. And we learned about Tara, and you got a little taste of her incredible generosity and kindness and care. And you learn that wisdom is associated with the feminine, the clarity of wisdom. And then we opened up through singing and chanting, which is so radical and beautiful and transformative. And we did it all together under this big sky with this beautiful moon that has risen during this session by candlelight. Getting gather all of this goodness in your heart, acknowledge it, feel good about it, let it nourish you. And then we start with the wish that may all beings benefit from this goodness. But because we're bodhisattvas, we don't just stop at the wish. We actually do an action. And the action is we give it away. So again, send it out like you're releasing a dove. And recognize that you just got everyone else's good karma. And that there are hundreds and thousands of practitioners on this earth that are dedicating all of their dharma practice and all of their good deeds to you, to all beings. Every day you're a recipient of it. Incredibly powerful practitioners sending you blessings all the time. Good, so we can say Emaho, how wonderful, in Sanskrit and Tantric tradition. Emaho.
Emaho.
Good. Thank you all so much. Such a pleasure, such a wonderful, fun day. Tomorrow we're going to start at 9 o'clock, which is not what your schedule says. So take note, your schedule says 9:30. It has warmed up substantially, but they've also turned the boiler up, so your room should be hotter. If you please use your space heaters sparingly, because it tripped the circuit last night. But you shouldn't need it because it's warmer and they turn the boiler up. But just an FYI. Was there any other announcements?
There's a sit at 7 too.
Oh, yeah. There's a sit at 7 with Neil, thank you. That's right, time. Yeah, sorry. Oh, and you, there's no more talking. Do you want to smile at each other before you go away? truly, thank you all. It was a really lovely day. You all did such a good job today. You meditated very nicely. You asked really nice questions. You opened up super nicely. I'm super impressed, super proud of you. Really, really, really lovely. So thank you, I rejoice in you. Very, very big deal. You should feel very, very good about your practice today. Super special. Okay, thank you. We'll see you all in the morning.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.